You know, I feel a little bit like James Lipton of the Actors Studio here.
You even have really, the...
Yeah. I was going to show you. I got the beard. I was going to bring a stack of cards, but I decided not to. And I promise I will not ask you what your favorite color is this evening. I will ask you, though, a couple of questions, and we want to start with Henry Cisneros, because chronologically, it'll make sense historically. We gave Mayor Castro first billing because he's the current mayor, and alphabetically, CA comes before CI. So we'll have Henry Cisneros lead off for the first question, and then after Henry finishes, if you'll chime in to answer the same question. Can you describe the political landscape confronting you upon your becoming mayor, and what challenges you saw that you felt you needed to address upon entering office?
Henry, thank you very much. My tocayo, who I've known since Sacred Heart in the neighborhood. It's an honor to be president with Mayor Castro, whose mother is the first person I remember when I arrived at kindergarten at Little Flower School. Mm-hmm. So this is a small town with long-time associations. Charlie, thank you for helping put this together. Once a president, always a president. You still look presidential to me. And Alex and Art and the rest of the team here at St. Mary's, congratulations. And I want to be brief in my response, but let me just say congratulations on the everlasting impact that St. Mary's has had on San Antonio in many, many ways. The law school, the pre-med program that has spawned doctors, but very importantly, the political, and I use that word advisedly, the political impact. Some of the great names of St. Mary's and those years, like Dr. Crane, Bill Crane, who spawned talents like Willie Velasquez and like Lionel Sosa, who became the controller and head of the Immigration Service, controller in Houston, head of the Immigration Service. All of them got their start, not just academically, but in terms of values, public values, here at St. Mary's. And Bill Crane used to say, I don't teach policy. I don't teach public administration. I teach politics, a politics grounded in values. And Charlie, you were right there and part of that process. Thank you very sincerely for the impact that St. Mary's has made in this city and its politics. Let me go directly to the question, and I will answer it briefly so that we can go to Mayor Castro's response and then also get to your questions as soon as possible. The environment that I came into as mayor was a very tumultuous setting. The 1970s were a period in which San Antonio could have gone either way, into really serious divisions, even violence, but for sure kind of long-term political combat and stalemates, or a direction in which we finally figured out, look, we've got to live together, and we've got to figure out how we're going to work together. The 1970s had been a period in which we had a massive referendum on development over the aquifer with the business community coming out against the council's position that we had to protect the water supply. We had a knockdown, drag-out battle over the nuclear project and whether or not we should be involved in the South Texas nuclear project. We had a huge issue when the Justice Department intervened and said our system of voting was unconstitutional and ushered in the process by which we went to a 10-1 districting plan. And it passed by the equivalent of one vote per precinct around the city in a very, very close election. And then the city suddenly was confronted with a minority majority city council with six minority persons on a council that had never had more than three, and all of those younger and products of the kind of politics that St. Mary's taught. So it was an incredible period of transformation. We had a bond issue, for example, that was originally to be passed, and then The business community opposed it, but the minority council members decided to go forward with it just to prove a point, and the business community decided to defeat it just to prove a point. I mean, it was a meltdown. So we got things calmed down in sort of the 79 to 81 period, and that cooled things enough that I could, when Mayor Cockrell decided not to run for office, I decided to go for it. Frankly, I had been wanting to be mayor for a long, long time, ran for the city council in order to someday be mayor. That came, and I'll be just one sentence, from my experience as an administrative assistant at the National League of Cities, seeing firsthand the impact that mayors like John Lindsay in New York and Daley in Chicago and Carl Stokes in Cleveland could have. And it just sort of embedded in me at a time of great tumult in the country at large that this was an honorable way to make a difference, to start at the city level and work at the grassroots. So anyway, the long and short is I was able to get elected in 1981. It was one of those elections where the people came out. I thought I could get elected if I had 28% of the Anglo vote, but I could get like 80% of the Latino vote and maybe 75% of the African-American vote. And instead, I got 42% of the Anglo vote and 90% of Latinos and African-Americans. So it was a great, great win. But it was one of those where the long and short, I don't want to sound immodest, but I had done enough as a council member to prove to people that we were going to fight for their interest in a different way, that it created a sense of excitement. And I had no idea what the result would be. I remember that night, election night, I ended at Collins Gardens at 7 p.m., when they closed the polls, and then I went home to take a shower before going to the event, whatever it was going to be, victory party or defeat. And the early vote came in, and I had lost the early vote. And I thought, "Woo, this day is not going the way I hoped. This is going to be..." But the turnout on election day was so massive and so excited, you ended up winning. So let me just close by saying, I entered office with a sense that what I needed to do was bring the city together. And I had articulated over the previous 6 years and in that election my view that the central theme that would move us forward was to deal with the poverty of San Antonio and the lack of growth by focusing on jobs. And articulating the case that the city government needed to be more than a provider of municipal services, but a basic factor in augmenting the growth of jobs in San Antonio. Whatever we could do that would enhance jobs, 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 and after that, incomes, 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 was the way we were going to bring this city together. Because the Latino community needed the jobs, the African-American community needed the jobs, the progressive Anglo community wanted the business, labor wanted the incomes. I mean, the coalition that I thought was the future of San Antonio was addressed by being really, really deadly serious about the jobs agenda. Let me just close by saying I'm very proud of Mayor Castro's work. We have had now, since Mayor Cockrell, who preceded me and served for 6 years, a fairly consistent current central stream of San Antonio politics, which revolves around this agenda of jobs, incomes, and general progress. Mayor Castro is the first to take it to a new level and add his own logic, which is, yes, it is about jobs, and yes, it is about incomes, but the new requirements of city progress require heightened levels of investment in human capital. And he's been really good, true to his word, with Cafe College, as you mentioned, and the pre-K program, which is a eternal legacy that he will have created. To put the city, imagine this, the city government asking people to tax themselves to put in place a pre-K program of pre-K campuses around the city is taking it to a new level and creating an example across the country. So, Henry, I hope that's enough to start the process.
Plenty.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here with Henry.
It's fair to say, Henry, I wouldn't be mayor now if you had not been mayor and hadn't inspired a whole generation of folks, of which I'm a part of, to get interested in public service. And so it goes without saying that you set the standard that all of us are still trying to chase in many ways. And as Dr. Flores said, put the model in place that we're still working off of. I want to thank you, Dr. Flores, and also President Cottrell, Alex Briceño, who's doing great things at VIA now, and Dr. Vega, who I know is here, and especially all the students who are here as well. With a special shout out to, I think, the urban economic development folks. Francis told me to do that. And also to Councilman Saldana, my colleague, who's here along with Councilman Nurnberg. I came into office in 2009 as mayor, but I ran in 2001 for city council. And I've said around town many times, and I won't go through all of it again now, but I basically got interested in running for office when I got away from San Antonio, and I could see San Antonio in a different light. And I could see in the Bay Area of California, when I went to Stanford, a community over there that was higher income level, more innovative, higher education level, and yet at the same time here, a community that was more tight-knit and was also culturally diverse, and where people of different backgrounds and perspectives got along well. And my interest was, well, how could you combine the best of those two communities? And my senior honors thesis at Stanford was about Henry and economic development in the 70s and 80s. And Henry, you remember better than I do that you used to talk about this two-fisted approach in the late 70s and early 80s of investing in jobs and opportunity as the common denominator to bring the city together and move us all forward, and also in brain power and in human capital. And y'all pursued that in the early 80s, pursuing engineering, I think, master's or PhD program, or maybe it was just BA at that time.
Yeah, it was just the engineering school.
The engineering school at UTSA. The Education Partnership and the later in the 1980s, the Literacy Centers and the Library Bond and the 89 Bond issue. And so I had in my mind when I ran for City Council that what we needed to do was to continue a lot of that legacy and focus as much as possible on creating brain power in San Antonio so that people would have the opportunity that we all want for them. And just quickly, the way that I think about it is there are basically three things that a city needs to get right. That education and economic development that I put together, that I lumped together, and I think we agree on that. Quality of life issues, the arts, parks, downtown, what makes a city exciting and nice to live in, and then just the basic stuff like public safety and infrastructure and governance that Lila was great at in bridging those divides when we went to single member districts in 77. And if you look at the different mayors, you can tell that all of us have had a commitment, to the model that Henry set, but people have their different focus areas. So when I think about Hardberger and Peak, for instance, I think of quality of life. Mm-hmm. Peak with those linear parkways and back then Proposition 1, and we see the great results of that now. Hardberger with the museum reach of the river, with Main Plaza, with other things, and his focus on the arts, bringing it up to 15% from 8.5%. I think about Henry and his focus on economic development. And so taking from all of those things, when I got elected mayor, I had a very good foundation to build on, because Mayor Hardberger had been there for 4 years, and in the previous 4 years, when I had been a council member, Mayor Garza, I think, did a good job, but we also had these corruption scandals that had really tested the confidence that people had in City Hall, and Phil and Cheryl did a good job of helping to turn that around. And so I started with a fairly good, strong foundation to build off of, and I've been very pleased that I've had the opportunity to build on all of the work that has been done before, and especially make education a focus of my tenure in office, I think, in new ways.
Just a comment, an observation on your election in 81. It's the first time in the history of local politics that the Latino community outvoted the Anglo community. Was the 81 election? I haven't done an analysis since Ed Garza's campaign, so I can't tell you, but I'm going to probably be looking at that part of it.
I think Dr. Vega did one.
Yeah.
Of the 09.
I promised him a question because he's got a research project. He says, if I don't get a question in to Julian, I'm not going to give you a raise next year. So I got observation on something that happened in one of your elections was I supported you the first time you ran for mayor. And it cost me silence from Phil for a long time. He still looks at me like, okay.
Me too.
Yeah, doesn't he really? this question, by the way, was partially inspired by a conversation I had with a dear friend of mine, also a Central Catholic grad and a St. Mary's alum, Mr. Leo Rodriguez, sitting right over here. And Lee and I go back to before our wives knew each other, except they didn't know it. And it's really funny when we first got introduced. They know each other. Where are these guys? But anyway, thank you for the conversation and helping me formulate the following question. And I'm going to ask you to go first, Mayor Castro. It appears that a common denominator of both of your administrations was that you entered office with the city poised on transition. What role did you feel you needed to play in this regard? I'm talking about the transition, the developmental transition. As I said before, San Antonio is, in my perception, you're turning San Antonio into a 21st century city and developing it so it'll go beyond that. So, but what role do you feel you need to play in this particular regard? And why do you feel that this particular way? And what sort of things do you think you need to do to facilitate this process into the future?
Yeah. Well, and let me answer that, the last part of that. I think that what we always do as mayors is that you need to bring people together and find a consensus with a strong vision and then go execute on that vision. And Henry was terrific at that during his time in office. What I felt coming into my tenure was that we needed to raise the bar on our aspirations for San Antonio. I remember an economic development meeting, and you may remember this, Henry, that we all had fairly early on, probably in 09 or 2010, and I said to our economic development folks that I felt like San Antonio was someone that was dunking on a 9-foot hoop and celebrating. A basketball hoop is 10 feet, you know, that we needed to focus our attention in economic development and education really in pursuing brain power and the highest end of accomplishment that we possibly could. And I also felt as though, and this is why Henry's approach originally, that two-fisted approach was so important, that we needed to not only focus on things and what we could point to and build, but on the things that you can't just measure by pointing at them. You know, we're never going to be able to measure educational progress just by something that we can point to. There's a cafe college and there are pre-K for SA centers, but that's not really the point. The point is that 10 years from now, the rolls of our graduation, the list of graduates is going to be longer in our high schools and our colleges. Or the work that we're doing on health and wellness. I mean, that's something that people, you know, that we wanted to focus on, that people get excited about it, but they also say, well, that's such a long-term thing. But people are going to personally see the difference in that, but you're never going to actually be able to point to something you build and see the result. So I felt as though my role was to remind us of what our aspirations are, and also to focus on the things that are not just physical, but are some of the things that have the most important impact on the well-being and the prosperity of the city in terms of education, in terms of health and wellness, and those kinds of things.
Henry, may I take just the personal privilege of introducing my wife, Mary Alice?
Oh, sure, please.
Just recognizing former councilwoman, Mary Alice Smith. And the chairman of the Greater Chamber, Richard Pettis, also a former city councilman, who's here. And Cecilia Herrera, the new president of the Cisneros Center for New Americans. So I can't forget. On the issue of transition, and sort of, you know, kind of preparing the city for a new phase, I guess the backdrop of what I described earlier, in other words, if you take all of those dynamics that I described, the aquifer, the single-member districts, the bond issue fights, the nuclear project, it boils down to sort of two realities. One of them is that our city was very poor. It's hard to describe to students in 2014 what the 60s were like here and even the 70s when we still had Corrales just west of the downtown without plumbing, and when the Peace Corps sent people here to train for third world conditions before they sent them to Latin America where there were third world conditions. So that was one dynamic, and the other was the contentiousness, people at each other's throats. So I felt like whatever I did needed to both advance the ball substantively, as Mayor Costler just said, but also deal with inclusion of decision-making and representation. So on the substantive piece, I had studied what they did in Dallas in the 1960s called the Goals for Dallas program, which resulted in DFW Airport, and articulated a goals program geared toward 1990. This was 1983, so a seven-year horizon. I was tempted to set the horizon at 2000, but people wouldn't believe it. It felt Buck Rogers, you know, to say 2000. So we picked 1993 because it takes 7 years.
You might have to explain to these students who Buck Rogers is.
Okay. Well, kind of like...
who is Buck Rogers? No,
kind of like Thor. Or So anyway, we did this goals program, and that started us on the track toward inclusion as well, because every single one of those task forces, what we insisted would have a traditional San Antonian, white San Antonian, a Latino or Latina, and an African American as the tri-chairs. Everything was tri-chairs. Everything. 12 working committees, the main task force. We rarely made an appointment of any kind in the city that wasn't tri-chair. And people had to learn to talk to each other. And we were just coming through the single-member districts period, or we're still early in it. So we were kind of finding each other. And so the transition that I felt like needed to occur was on those two points, you know, kind of the substantive progress and then the absolute insistence on inclusion. Now, it was very interesting because, you know, I had a major ally on the inclusion front, which was cops. Cops could say things and do things that I couldn't do. So you had the Chamber of Commerce, which has been the traditional kind of power in the town, and all of a sudden the chamber had to deal with a rising power out of the neighborhoods insisting on drainage and streets and schools and police and doing it loudly, you know, blocking up the bank teller windows at the Frost Bank and having accountability sessions and such. And I then got to transform my role into sort of the honest broker, going to the business community and saying, you need to listen to them because you're not going to be able to pass the bond issues you want without their support. And then going to cops and saying, you need to listen to them because we're not going to have the money, you know, for the things we need to do without their support. I learned that from Andrew Young, who was mayor of Atlanta at the time. And he said, my job is to be the bridge and to go to the business community and say to them, you need the African-American community's votes for building a great Atlanta, and then go to the African-American community and say, you need the white community's money, the business community's money to build a great Atlanta. And so there's a real, I mean, it's not as stark now, but it was very stark then. Yeah. And that bridge role was a really important role. Today, we're a much more integrated place. I mean, Alex has been the longest serving city manager, and that was unthinkable in the 1970s, right? We've got an African-American heading CPS. That was the gold preserve, you know, CPS. Sure. And now we have Doyle Beneby, you know, leading that, the flagship. And then we have Robert Puente, heading the city water. I mean, these were positions beyond anybody's imagination of attainability, you know, as recently as the 70s. So we've come a very, very long way in those transitions. And let me just close by saying, I want to make sure you understand how dramatic and important I think the mayor's advocacy on this human capital agenda is. I am convinced it is a quantum leap for our city that is setting the pace in the country at large. And we can do it in San Antonio, because we've crossed all these other bridges of inclusiveness and participation and understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell you how blessed we are to live in a city with precisely the political chemistry that this city has. It's very rare, it's very special, and we can get some things done here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Now I'd like to open it to the floor to some questions from our students. There will be some microphones going around. Robin?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Stand up.
Yeah, please stand up. And introduce yourself. And
Robin Tatum, a graduate student here at St. Mary's International Relations Program. Thank you for setting this up. And
thank you both for being here tonight. So a question is for you, Mayor Castro. I understand SA 2020, and I understand Mayor Cicerano talking about the human capital agenda. We're talking about educating San Antonio. I'm concerned that there may be the possibility of a brain drain in 2025 if tech and if other industries aren't willing to open up doors and open up jobs for here in San Antonio. If you're promoting education very very assertively, are you aware that, or are you concerned that there might not be enough jobs to come in and fill in for the area because of maybe Silicon Valley growth or growth in D.C.? Just a general question on infrastructure.
Yeah.
Sorry if it's a little vague.
Yeah.
But
no, I mean, thank you very much for the question. And of course I'm concerned about that, and it's a challenge that San Antonio and a lot of other big cities have had. One bright spot was that I believe it was the 80-20 Foundation about a year and a half ago had an analysis commission that found that San Antonio ranked sixth among big cities in terms of brain gain, people right now actually with credentials moving into the community. But there is this challenge. We have, according to the Census Bureau now, I believe it's more than 125,000 people enrolled in college and graduate school. And at the same time, the Lumina Foundation and others have rated San Antonio near the bottom of the top 100 metros in terms of percentage of the population who have a two-year or four-year degree. And so, you know, it's almost like we have two issues. We have a lot of students here in the area, but obviously a lot of them are going somewhere else. Many of them are not completing their degree. A lot of them are going somewhere else if they do complete their degree. And then you have a whole bunch of other people in the population that just don't get that chance. So you need to address the education part so that more of them get into college. We have to do something that we haven't done well, which is focus on college completion, not just getting to college. And then, and this is what you began your question with, it's not enough for us to have all of these students in the city. It's okay, well, if you're going to keep them here, you know, and then attract more, what job opportunities do they have? And yes, it is a concern, and that's one of the reasons that we have remodeled our economic development approach to focus on higher-end jobs in 21st century industries. And Henry really pioneered this with his focus on the biosciences and healthcare. And now we've built on that with the new energy economy, obviously having Rackspace here and hopefully other companies that deal in cloud computing, cybersecurity. So it is a concern, and it's one that we have to approach from the bottom up, and also what happens after they complete college. The final thing I'll add is, even if you had the jobs, in theory, let's say that tomorrow you could wave a magic wand and have the jobs. The fact is that now when cities compete, they compete across a scale of quality of life. Young people want to be where there's, and they've always wanted to be, where there's things to do, where there's an exciting place. That has been, I think, the reason that Mayor Hardberger's work and Mayor Peake's work on the linear parkways, on the museum reach of the river, Nelson Wolf's work on the mission reach, and then what we're trying to do as part of the decade of downtown is so important, because you want it to be a thriving, exciting, culturally vibrant city where there's something for everyone. And the city that is doing that best in Texas is, of course, Austin. And it's no accident that you look at Austin and they have the education base, and not only that, they have the quality of life base. And they're clearly the hottest local economy right now in terms of their unemployment rate and the prospects of what they're getting. But San Antonio, I think, is catching up faster than we ever have in the city's history.
Yeah, just a real brief addition. I agree with everything the mayor has said. One thing I would say is that we need to get better at growing jobs from small business in the community. Entrepreneurial development is one of the great job sources of the future. And, I mean, you know, think about it. People are more in command of their capabilities with a computer. All kinds of what economists are calling the atomization of our economy, which is smaller, more nimble, quicker, smarter. And so we're going to grow, we're going to get less jobs by bringing them from the outside in big moves. Although every once in a while a Toyota falls from the sky, and that's a great thing, you know. And we need more, you know, rack space and USAA adds, you know, thousands of jobs. And Port San Antonio is a huge economic asset. So we want to play all of those. But we also want to encourage young people like you to say, you know what, I have an idea and I want to get some capital and I can pursue this and make something out of it. Because if you look at an economy like Austin's, a lot of it is coming out of just rising up.
That's a great point. Yeah. That's a great point.
Dr. Vega, you want to ask your question? I promised you I'd let you get a question.
Well, thank you very much. I have a lot of questions, of course. but I'll ask you a question that I hope that the students will gain from. You know, we have a lot of students who are ethnic minority and first-generation college students, and they, you know, come to a conversation like this, and they see the sort of the leadership that you provided, and, you know, maybe they misconceive the how easy it might have been, or... And I wonder if you might just describe some of the constraints that you've had and sort of the trade-offs that you've had in becoming public servants, and how might you might inspire them to take up the mantle and fill that gap as well.
Well, yeah, I'll take a stab at that. Well, I think, you know, just some of the obstacles are, of course, in the system that we have, for instance, in terms of our charter, serving on the city council is not a paid position, basically. And so when I got out of law school, you know, I was working as a lawyer, and it was very challenging to balance that with also trying to serve on the city council. I quit my job early on over this PGA Village issue in 2002, and then my house almost went into foreclosure like a year later, and then my brother and I had our own law firm, and so juggling all of that was a challenge. In terms of constraints, you know, sort of writ large, you're one of 11 people, and the mayor is not in our system. Is not the CEO of the city. The city manager is the CEO. At the same time, the system depends upon the mayor and the manager having a very good working relationship. And for all intents and purposes, if that is the case, then the mayor's agenda, along with five other council members at least, is the agenda that will be pursued. But that's still, I think, an overall constraint. You're not in a strong mayor form of government. And then there are the constraints I think that probably Henry saw more in spades
back in the late 70s and in 81 when he ran for mayor, of ethnic voting sometimes in these mayoral elections, people making assumptions about what you would bring to the office. We saw that in my 2005 race, much more than in the 2009 race. But I would say that that's generally been a challenge sometimes for folks.
First of all, let me say I encourage young people to aspire to public service. I think it's a noble profession. And though, you know, politicians get tagged for all kinds of things, you know, sort of cynically regarding the public and looking at people as, you know, kind of votes as opposed to real human beings with real problems and you know, being on it in order to climb the ladder as opposed to serve, I think that it is a noble calling. And you can do a lot of good for people, as Mayor Castro is demonstrating by his service. We know that there are professions that touch people's lives, like physicians who heal people, or teachers who inspire a young person, or clerics, clergy, who find someone at a moment of indecision and give them sort of certainty and a compass in life. Those are all professions where we know human beings are touched. But I'm convinced that what one can do in good quality public service, if not quite at that level, can get close, because you can really, really touch a lot of lives. So I strongly encourage it and encourage you to think about what profession prepares you best. I think that it probably is law. Witness the mayor's contributions and his brother from a law background, and many, many others who serve in legislatures and who serve in positions of public responsibility in the Congress, etc. However, there are other ways to learn things that you need in public service, like public administration and urban planning and education and a lot of other preparations. You do confront the issue that the mayor raised quite correctly, which I confronted as well, which was how do you make a living in a system that paid at the time $20 a week to serve on the city
still
council.
Does. Is that still? Yeah, Saldana and Nuremberg can still attest to that.
And so, you know, you have to do something else. I was a professor at UTSA, eventually part-time because my public duties require time. So that is a serious question, which is why law is a good, not only a good preparation. You learn to do research, you learn to speak, you learn to think on your feet, you learn the structure of law, but you also are more in command of your financial well-being because you can open a practice and work at it, whereas an employer might not give you the time to serve in public service or constrain it. So those are some serious constraints, I think, that exist in the San Antonio situation. But you can find ways around it, just like Henry B. Gonzalez found a way around it and served on the city council and then became a state senator and then became a great congressman, the first Latino elected in the continental United States, who came from San Antonio. I mean, everybody who you can think of that's made a difference in San Antonio politics, Congressman Gonzalez, I'm talking about Latinos now who shaped the city's Hispanic politics, Henry B. Gonzalez, Joe Bernal, Pete Torres, Albert Pena, multiple members of city councils, Mayor Castro today, all have confronted those issues and said, I want to serve, and I think I have something to offer, and found a way around the constraints.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, I might say among the people who pay the price are our families for the lessened income.
That's true.
That could be afforded if we put this amount of time and energy into doing something that was more remunerative. So I have to pay homage to my wife, who in our family is the person who worked through it.
We have a question over on the left. We have a question on the left over there. Go ahead. Go ahead.
And I grew up here in the Jefferson area, and I just had a question about the whole education topic. And the question is that with the pre-K for San Antonio, the younger generation is addressed, but as I was interning with San Antonio for Growth on the East Side and also here as a vice president of the Neighborhood Association, I'm concerned about that generation that's not going to be part of the pre-K for San Antonio and that are currently in their 20s or early 30s and did not receive the education that they need for these new jobs that are coming up. Is there anything that you have in mind or your administration is thinking about addressing the young adults that are already here that are going to need preparation for those jobs? Currently, Project Quest with Rackspace does do some work similar to what it addresses that concern, but I'm wondering if there's anything your administration is looking into. And also, is there any way that the city of San Antonio could be more involved in the curriculum? Whereas with standardized testing, I felt at least that there was so many limits to getting the quality of education. Here you hear on 98.5 The Beat, or you hear on all these radio stations, they'll advertise Career Point. They'll advertise these for-profit colleges and universities, and I feel that they're targeting our neighborhoods because they know that we need the education, and there are many testimonies of people that don't get the quality of education they need.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, you're right. I mean, we have a challenge of creating a great workforce that means that we need to focus not just at the beginning, but also all along the way. Recently, SA 2020 called together a task force called the Talent Pipeline Task Force to take a look at, in a comprehensive way, how we can strengthen the pipeline of talent and focus on each of those different age groups. So you're right, Project Quest is a good example of working with adults, basically, folks who a lot of times people have given up on, single moms who are raising their children but who are intelligent and can go back to school and get their GED and then go on to the community college or get a certification and get a good paying job so they can provide for their family. My hope is that we can find good ways to expand upon not just Project Quest, but workforce training in general. It's something that I do intend to focus on. I mentioned that at the State of the City last year and this year. The other thing that we need to do at the city is take a look again at this issue of adult literacy. Henry, I believe in the 89 bond issue, helped to create these centers and to focus on our libraries. And we do have a large population in San Antonio that is not literate, that are adults that could get more gainful employment if they were. And don't get me wrong, there's a tremendous amount of work that the school districts and nonprofits are doing with adult literacy. The city has never been the main player in that. But I think that when we come at it again, we need to come at it probably in a way that is new and even more comprehensive than before. And so look for that basically in the summer as we go through this budget. And then the last question that you asked, I think about the curriculum but also the advertising part. Well, we can't really do anything to stop their advertising. In terms of the curriculum of the schools, that's something that's mostly affected at the state level. I believe the State Board of Education, and they've had a topsy-turvy last few years with folks who have very extreme views on it. But we can do something about influencing the people that get elected to the State Board of Education, at least here. We can continue to work with our school districts. We have 15 different independent school districts that operate within San Antonio. The way that I've seen my role is if there are gaps that we can fill in a smart way, like Cafe College, like Pre-K for SA, is there something related to X, Y, or Z, maybe curriculum, maybe something else, that makes sense for the city?
I think the mayor is doing a magnificent job of articulating leadership in education and articulating the case for educational improvements. First of all, the city can't progress. The organic city cannot progress without education, so it is appropriate that the mayor be a voice for one of the most fundamental things that will reshape the future of the city, which is education. Even though the city government doesn't have direct involvement in education, there is that leadership role, and he's played it very, very well. I was in Las Vegas yesterday at the invitation of the mayor there, the city council, and the city manager to comment on their strategic plan. And they're still thinking about the city government as the purveyor of municipal services and have yet to raise their sights to understanding the impact in these larger questions like economic development and like education. I mean, it's amazing to me, having gone through what they have, that they still haven't seen, you know, what an immense mechanism exists that can do good. So we're blessed that we're over the hump with respect to the city accepting the mayor's leadership on this issue, and then a mayor who is willing to exert it. I would just say that I think there's a lot of experimentation and excitement across the city. Pre-K is one of those that people are really hoping, have great hopes for. Wouldn't have voted for it if they hadn't, right? It passed, tax included. But one of the areas that to me is the most exciting is what's happening in terms of the number of charter schools and magnet schools and other unorthodox arrangements that are beginning to take hold across the city. We have to be very careful that we don't do damage to the public schools in the process, particularly the weaker public schools that are emptying out, and we see schools that are having to close and so forth. But we also have some first-class charters coming to town. Great Hearts, Idea, Basis, Rocket Ship, et cetera. All of them, you know, sort of picking spots and picking fields. And I think the result of that, you know, with some responsibility, can only be good. We also have to be careful that we don't do damage in the process to the parochial schools, which has always been a great tradition in San Antonio. But just look at the number that have closed in recent years. Christ the King, St. Joseph's, Sacred Heart, Guadalupe,
St. Philip's
of Jesus, I think St. Benedict's, if I'm not mistaken, over on W.W. White. Schools that used to have 300 students now, like St. Margaret Mary's, have 90. You know, so we got to figure out some kind of larger map or plan, you know, to as you say,
that's true.
Not just fill in the gaps, but rationalize and get people to rise to the challenge.
Yeah, maybe that's what we need, an educational summit that's really, you know, just holistically look. I think we have a question right over here.
I wanted to ask, as far as what would be your advice for public servants at the state and national level as far as following San Antonio's example of responding to the needs of a minority community, specifically a Latino community, especially in the areas of education? And also, what would you say is the end vision or the end goal for San Antonio as far as what industries to bring to San Antonio to attract the talent and to keep people here and to continue to build and transform the city?
As to the national level, look, we're blessed to have, the mayor has frequently said, look at San Antonio because it's where the rest of the country is going to need to be, right? So we came to this issue of diversity and demography and inclusion earlier than most and dealt with it, and we're way ahead of the curve. We really have things to teach people across the country and the country at large. We're also blessed in that we're working at the local level. And I think you can get things done, imagine things, and innovate at the local level that you cannot do at the national level because the constraints are so immense and the players are so stalemated. I'm very frustrated on the national scene. I am not optimistic at the moment. The Tea Party, the stalemated dynamics of the Congress, nothing that I can see ahead changes it, no matter who wins in November, you know, no matter who is the next president. So I don't know whether there's a direct correlation or transfer from what we're doing locally, except to say we produce talent, like the mayor's brother, Joaquin, who learned his lessons here and takes them onto a larger stage, you know, and over time maybe the accumulation of talent and representation takes some of the lessons that we've developed here and other places, other cities, like Cory Booker out of Newark now, a United States senator, for example, and it begins to make a dent on the national scene. I think we spoke earlier to the issue of businesses or industries. The mayor's right to be pursuing some of these new, alternative, higher-wage industries. Port San Antonio gives us a real crack at avionics and aviation. Toyota gives us a real crack at more manufacturing. Our biosciences complex gives us a real opportunity at medical devices and medical research and pharmaceuticals. All of those are things that I think will create a lot of jobs, as well as what I mentioned earlier, which is entrepreneurship. I really think we could do a lot better. No city in the country that I know of, I don't know of a city in America that has mastered how you help small businesses effectively. We could be, because of our makeup, we could be a real pioneer in that area.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, Henry said it extremely well, and I think, you know, very well thought out. I would say it's difficult to replicate what you can do in a local environment because at the state and national level, you're not operating in a nonpartisan environment. And so there's a pressure to toe a certain line depending on which party you're in. And there are rules that are implemented at the national level that mechanically make it difficult. For instance, the Hastert rule in Congress that says that a piece of legislation won't be considered on the floor for a vote in the House of Representatives unless a majority of the majority supports it. So in this case, a majority of the Republicans, a few years ago, a majority of the Democrats, and if they say, no, we don't want it to even be voted on, then it's not going to get voted on. So to tie it back into your concern over the Latino community, this issue of comprehensive immigration reform, if you just took a vote from what the Gang of Eight of the Senate passed, the bipartisan legislation in the House, if they could take a vote, that thing would probably pass with 195 or so Democrats and a few Republicans, but the Speaker won't bring it to the floor because a majority of the Republicans don't support it. And that goes back and forth. You know, when the Democrats had control, there are issues that they did that too as well. But my point is, if I had advice, it would be, how do you create more mechanisms in those institutions that allow for bipartisanship and mirror more the local government? Like, it would be fascinating if on votes, let's say, you know, this is an experiment that'll never happen, but for instance, in a vote at the State House in Austin or in Congress, that you would allow on a vote for, let's say, the votes for one day, allow the representatives to vote in a secret ballot that would then be published 3 months later or 6 months later. So eventually people would know how their, before election time, how their representative voted. But at least in the heat of the moment, they wouldn't, you know, they could cast a secret ballot substantively to vote their heart. And at the margins, whether that kind of thing would make a difference.
I think we have a question over here in the back.
Evening, Mr. Castro. My name is Eduardo Sosa. I grew up in Reynosa, Tamaulipas, the Valley. Firstly, I'd like to say that I admire your vision in education reform and everything. And my question to you, because you said that you saw the heavy marginalization when you went to study in California and like that. Right now, Mexico is going under heavy educational reform. My question to you is, what your advice to Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, to re-solidify the education policy in Mexico right now?
Well, first of all, I don't think I'm qualified to give the Mexican president advice on anything. Let me start there. In fact, Henry is probably more qualified and more familiar with the issues. First of all, it's very clear that President Peña Nieto is making reforms
that are very substantive and are, that are great in number. I think there are five or six different major reforms that he's pursuing. If I had any advice, it would be that, and it's kind of already going through it, so, but if we were starting from zero, from day one, it might be to evaluate the pace of those reforms. And the jury is still out in terms of how many of them will be successful. There's a lot of excitement, for instance, here in South Texas about the oil and gas reforms. In Mexico, I know things like the education reform has been more controversial and so forth. But my advice would be, at any time of significant change, there's going to be significant backlash as well. And the number one thing that you could do is to bring people of different perspectives together. He seems to be doing that. And then beware of the opposition force or the backlash that you're going to get from the rapid pace of change.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that the situation in Mexico prior to these reforms was dire. There were schools in Mexico where students went about 4 hours a day, about 9 o'clock to about 1 o'clock. The teachers' unions had so dominated the work rules and so forth. You had the president of the teachers' union flying around the country in a G4 jet on the, you know, the high life style. You know, students were not learning. Dropout rate was immense. High school graduations through the floor, and you can't build a country in this world economy that way. I think the president understood it, and the Mexican public understood it, and bore with him through the very difficult process. I was in Mexico several times during the time last year when the streets were completely blocked up. You couldn't move in central Mexico City because the teachers' unions had blocked up the streets, including out in rural areas in Chiapas, and was stopped at a roadblock of the teachers' union. So it was a knockdown, drag-out battle, but the president did what he had to do. And the world ought to encourage him, because we need a strong Mexico, a vital Mexico, a prosperous Mexico, an educated Mexico, and the old way was not going to get him there.
I have a question back in here.
Mr. Castro, Mr. Cisneros, Mr. Flores, thank you for holding this public forum. My name is Rene Gonzalez. I'm studying public administration at San Antonio College right now. Came across a recent report, Reagan Turner, former Harvard graduate, about how downtown and the central business district are functioning at a 67% occupancy rate, which equates to basically one in every three buildings in the downtown and central business district area are vacant. And in fact, there are entire multitudes of lots on Commerce Street, St. Mary's, and others that are just completely vacant. And so my question that I pose is how, aside from municipal code and private property rights that favor landowners over the city of San Antonio, how historically we've come to this condition. Thank you.
I mean, first of all, I would say that you're right to recognize that we have a lot of work to do downtown, and also that I would say that that's not a unique challenge to San Antonio, that if you look at downtowns across the United States and probably across the world, that there's a lot of work to do, and we've seen a tremendous amount of sprawl in our city over the years. But I am optimistic that that's changing. And so since 2011, for instance, we've seen $449 million of investment in housing in downtown urban core projects. And the city has incentivized $37 million of that. From 2011 to now, there are 2,471 units that either have been built, they're under construction, or they're in the planning phase, but they are going forward. They're actual legitimate projects. We have the Mission Reach and the Museum Reach that have been completed in the last couple of years, and the Performing Arts Center that's going to open up in September of this year that will be an accelerant to downtown activity. We're working on Hemisphere to, again, create a great urban park in the middle of downtown. And so I'm sure that we got here for different reasons. And most of it has been, I think, market forces. Land was cheaper outside in beyond 410 and now beyond 1604. People moved out. The school districts play a very significant role in this. School districts that have had higher achievement in the far-flung areas of our city. You need to really focus on the improving the quality of these urban core school districts. That's probably step one, frankly, and making it more appealing for people to move into these areas. And then making that area exciting so that people want to be a part of it. You're seeing that now at the Pearl in Southtown, along Houston Street. So, you know, I said that we would have a decade of downtown, and you know, I'm glad that we're only in 2014. So we still have
we're having it.
Five and a half years, almost 6 years to get there. But we'll get there.
And I would say to this young man who I assume you're a student.
Yeah, he
okay.
is.
Okay. And as an old professor, I would say dig a little deeper and challenge your own conclusion, because I think I heard you say the problem is we value property rights over public purposes or something like that is what you said. And I would argue that that's too simple an analysis, that what fundamentally is required is the economic juice of landlords and, I mean, I'm sorry, of tenants of office space and tourist dollars and residential rents in going into downtown spaces. And there's just, I mean, you got to have the economic juice to sustain office buildings, occupancy, the building of new rental spaces, which is happening big time, huge numbers of new commitments of rental space and for sale units in the downtown. The mayor ticked off a number of things: Hemisphere, the investments in the convention center, the continued investments in the Riverwalk, the museum reach to the north, new apartment buildings like the Vistana, like the ones around SAC, like the ones in the Pearl, like the ones in Southtown. I mean, there is more happening in the downtown right now than we have had in probably three decades combined. Combined. You take all the activity of three decades and more is happening right now. But we need more. Obviously, a lot of it today is driven by tourism. That's probably not the sufficient answer for us, you know. So we got to figure out how to get some headquarters downtown. Everybody's been working hard on that. Got to figure out how to bring some small businesses downtown and have to figure out how to get more people living downtown. I think one analysis that I saw said certain kinds of uses, like a grocery store, require about 30,000 people living in the downtown. Today, I think we have about 15,000 living in the downtown. So this is just a matter of occupancies, rents, people willing to pay, people locating their businesses, and I think we're on the right track. I guarantee you, compared to many, many downtowns in the country, ours is vibrant. Compared, you know, but we have a long way to go.
Yeah. We have a question, right? Oh, okay.
Hello, my name is Kevin Machula, I'm a senior science major here. You both spoke, Secretary Cisneros spoke briefly about this, but today there are so many politicians who stand against government rather than what government can do. You've both taken approaches that really seize on government's ability. So what leadership advice would you give young people who are seeking public service?
My advice would be, first of all, to understand what your passion, what your reason for going into public service is. For me, it's that when I went away, I saw in my own life what was possible and around me what could be possible. I felt very blessed, and I wanted to do what I could to help ensure that other people had opportunities like that. And so, you know, my first agenda, my first flyer that I ever put out was something that I called a smart growth knowledge economy agenda, that I wanted us to go from a smiles-based economy to a files-based economy, which is probably too glib, but you get my point. You know, it was to create more opportunity.
And whatever it is that you have a passion about, there has to be a reason that you're going into public service. And you have to understand what you believe in your core, you know, your gut. Basically, you have to have a worldview. That doesn't mean that you have to have decided your position on 50 different issues, because you know, sometimes that's going to change when you get new information, you hear the arguments, you get more experience. All of us sometimes change our opinion on things. But it's the people who don't have, I think, a certain core set of beliefs from their faith or just because or their background that don't have that, that often tilt with the wind and get into problems in public service, or are willing to do whatever, you know. If they think they need to say this to get a whole bunch of votes, they'll say that. If they need to say something different next week, they'll say something different. And then finally, I would just say, my advice would be, don't be afraid to go into it at a young age. We need more people who are young, and your idealism is a positive thing, not a negative thing. There's a real value to that. And especially if you go into it at a young age, understand that the best thing that you can do is to listen to other people, because they think that you're going to come in and think you know everything, and you really don't know everything. I didn't know it. No, none of us did go in, you know. You never know everything, but especially if you're just starting off. And so as you go forward, you know, be willing to listen to other people and incorporate what they're saying into your own perspective.
I think the mayor's correct, and I would add just another level, or Philip, if you will, because we're at a Catholic institution, which is St. Mary's, which has done a fabulous job over the years of integrating Catholic values and public service. It's my lifelong belief that God put us on this earth to make it better. And at the end of the day, we'll be judged on whether or not we used our time to make it better. It's a very hard test. You know, it means you really can't take a day off, because your job is to do the very best you can over a course of a lifetime to touch other people's lives and make the world better. So, you know, I think that's deeply ingrained in some of the Catholic encyclicals, some of the papal teachings, the Bible, the Church's teachings. So it's appropriate to sort of take that, try to understand it, and ask yourself individually, what am I doing about that? And how can I do my part? Now, not everybody has to run for public office and be a public official to make that kind of difference. You can make that kind of difference being a Little League coach. You can make that kind of difference working in your local parish. You can make that kind of difference on the job. You can make that kind of difference in the classroom, being a teacher. There's many, many places and many, many ways. Everybody will find their own answer. But I think that there are high expectations of us as human beings, right? And particularly as people who've had the advantage of an education like St. Mary's and the Catholic values it seeks to imbue. Every one of us, there's no exemption from this. There's no one who gets a free pass. Everybody has to earn their place on this planet. And the harder we are on ourselves and ask the question in a trying way, you know, a disciplined way, the better we're going to find our own answer. And I encourage as much public service, whatever form it takes, that you can give.